Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the All Inclusive Podcast with Jay Ruderman.
Hi, I'm Jay Ruderman. All Inclusive is a podcast focused on inclusion and social justice. Join me as I interview leaders and experts on the latest news focused on advocacy for social justice. In order to make progress that will lead to a more equitable future, honest discussions must be held. That is what All Inclusive is all about. Listen and subscribe to the All Inclusive Podcast on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Visit the show website for more information and full episode transcripts at www.allinclusivepodcast.com.
This is Judaism Unbound, episode 283, Planet of the Jews. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And today we're excited to be having a conversation with novelist Philip Grobart. He has written quite a few novels exploring Judaism in a variety of ways. His most recent novel, Women and God, tells the story of an investigation at a major American seminary where a rabbi is tasked to investigate her former teacher for sexual impropriety. As the book jacket describes it, her investigation uncovers a complex series of events in a tangled web of dark secrets within the Jewish community. Now, that's the book that we're going to be discussing for the first part of today's conversation, but it's important for me to mention, and we certainly know that some of our friends have heard of Philip Grobart because of another novel that he wrote called Planet of the Jews that we're going to talk about in the latter part of today's conversation. It's a story within a story where a Jewish comic book editor is mysteriously given short Jewish science fiction stories telling about a process of trying to get the Jews off the planet Earth because of anti-Semitism and to settle another planet. There's no way to do this book justice. You just have to read it. And I should say that some of our friends read it every year. Planet of the Jews has definitely reached cult classic status among some people that I know who get together to read sections of it every year or as often as they're able to get together. We're excited to continue exploring this topic of Jewish fiction with our guest today, Philip Grobart. Philip Grobart is the author of quite a few other novels, and he is a former congregational rabbi and Jewish educational leader, having held leadership positions at the Shalom Hartman Institute and the Yiddish Book Center. We're really excited to have this conversation with him. So, Philip Grobart, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here. It's an honor.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the question of, I guess, how you decide to write another book. You know, you've written a few, and yet it's not your full-time day job. So I'm curious what the impulse is to decide, I'm going to write another book. And then specifically with Women and God, how did you come to decide to write this book?
I'll go back. I mean, there's never been a time in my adult life when I didn't have some kind of book in mind, some kind of story in mind. Even if I had jobs that were very far from allowing me the time to write, I still had ideas about stories to tell. Mostly it was stories, novels. That's mostly what I write. Other people talk about, writer's block. I've always had the opposite of writer's block. I mean, I always have too many ideas just kind of floating in my head. And that's also, I mean, that's what gives me the idea to just start writing is that it's as simple and as primitive as I just have this story to tell. It's just kind of like invading my consciousness. And there's a point where I just have to do it. And the fact that I've always had to have day jobs, you know, as a rabbi in the community hasn't distracted from the fact that I still sort of need to write these stories. So with my latest book, it's like every other book I've written. I just had this itch in the back of my mind, like here's a really interesting story. I try to accomplish things when I'm writing a novel beyond just, hey, I got to tell this story. But the original impulse is really just very primitive, I think, feeling that goes deep into what it means to be human, which is just I've got a story to tell and I want to share it with as many people as I can.
Well, obviously, there's been a lot of Me Too scandals in the world and in the Jewish world. And I'm just wondering, was there a moment where that specifically morphed in your head into a story that you needed to tell? Or how, you know, what was it in that case, but also more broadly? Like, I've actually been thinking a lot lately about this piece of Talmud that I came across recently. My wife and I have been doing this daily study of the daily page of Talmud, and there's this story that's been on my mind for a long time. It's a story about two of the top rabbis in the Talmud, and the story talks about how they would go to another city and say, who wants to be my bride for the day? And then there's this like aphorism at the end that says something like, it's better for a person to have a loaf of bread in his basket, and then he won't go looking for bread elsewhere, you know, is the upshot of it. And it felt to me like there was this really important question to ask, which is that are these kind of exceptional cases, or is there something potentially that is built into the fabric, not of Judaism per se, but of any area of human endeavor that's built in a patriarchal world where it's only men and there's a lot of ego involved, you know, in these sort of, quote, great rabbis. And I'm wondering, as you write a book like this, do some of those questions come up for you, and how do you think through them?
There's this link between spiritual charisma, religious charisma, and sexual misbehavior. And so, you know, we have that in the Jewish world, and I live in the Jewish world, so I notice it in the Jewish world. It's not unique to Judaism. The Catholic Church has it all over the place. Your local yoga instructor, you know, may have violated all sorts of sexual prohibitions. And so we have it in Judaism. And before the Me Too movement, we had it, you know, some of it even predatory. So what are the implications for, let's say it's an important spiritual mentor. So how do his students feel afterwards? Or sometimes it's her students. I mean, how do they feel? How does it affect the community? How do institutions respond, you know, when the person is central to that institution? How do synagogues respond? I think these are important issues to surface as a community, but as a novelist, that's not my primary job, is to instruct institutions how to handle these issues. But I think all of us in the Jewish community can do some thinking through it. I think that's a story can do that, a novel can do that. Let's imagine, you know, this particular spiritual giant who's involved in this particular scandal. And how are all the people around him going to respond?
So I'd love to open people up to the world that exists in your novel, to not to go like all the way into the characters. But this is a really interesting setting that you've set up in Women in God, which, I mean, the main characters are deep, deep in Jewish institutions. We're not talking about, you know, people who are Jewish, who, you know, maybe they do or don't go to synagogue. These are like rabbis and administrators and donors and like all directly tied to various Jewish institutions and networks of Jewish institutions. And I was curious, especially maybe this ties to your other work and to Planet of the Jews. I know you've written about folks who are decidedly not that, who are Jewish, but not rabbis, not people necessarily working for Jewish institutions. And so I guess I would love to hear about why it went in the way it did with these central rabbinic kinds of characters and rabbinical student characters and their various friends, family members, etc.
Yeah, I mean, a simple answer is that you sort of write what you know. So in this particular book, I mean, it's the world of synagogues and Jewish institutions and rabbinical school, and I know those places, so I could write pretty easily about them without having to do a lot of research. But there was something, you know, I guess for me that's a little bit deeper. I wanted to do a kind of counterfactual. So a counterfactual is like an alternate history. Because I'm explicit in the book that this is taking place not just in the Jewish world, but in the conservative Jewish world. I'm a conservative rabbi. And I try to imagine, so what would happen if the leading rabbinical school in the conservative movement, and it's fictional in the book, so it's not the actual Jewish Theological Seminary, but it's a fictional. What if they hired, you know, a real spiritual giant who is just out there playing guitar and sharing pearls of wisdom and is really influential, as opposed to what JTS does, which is mostly academics. And it's not an attack on JTS, but JTS and my teachers were mostly academics, and we learned to become rabbis through academics. What if somewhere along the line, a rabbinical school, a non-Orthodox rabbinical school, chose, you know, real charismatic spiritual giants as its leaders? And how would that affect the way conservative rabbis do their jobs? So once I had that idea, of course, I had this idea. And then what if those great spiritual giants, or one of them, misbehaves? You know, what does that do to his students? What does it do to the institution? So I wanted to kind of play around with that Jewish institution, a rabbinical school, and just ask myself those questions.
When I think about it, that you can read something as, yeah, this is a book about sexual misconduct, but you can also read it as this is a book about the dangers of you know, getting too close to the sun, you know, and that kind of spiritual power is dangerous. And that does feel to me like it's one of these things that we don't talk a lot about on this podcast in specifics, but that really is kind of lurking there, that we in a world, maybe it's like you constructing this fictional Jewish theological seminary version, you know, it's like in a world in which that isn't the experience of most people most of the time, you can kind of lament it and wish for it and say, oh, wouldn't it be better if we had that? But you know, if there's ever any chance that we are going to get closer to having that, then we better also do some of the planning for, you know, in case that happens. It actually just reminds me of a book I just finished reading called The Premonition by Michael Lewis, which is about the people preparing in the U.S. government for a pandemic. And then, you know, in various ways, it doesn't work out.
I mean, the danger of that kind of spiritual heat goes in all sorts of ways. I mean, there's a danger to the victims. And I don't want to say the danger or the risk. I mean, I would say the risk, let's say, to the teacher is that all this adulation becomes really heady and, you know, literally goes to their head. And before they know it, they've kind of slid into really inappropriate places. And I think that's worth exploring. I thought it was worth exploring in a book. And religion is a particularly interesting case study of Me Too type misbehavior, because you know, unlike actors, let's say Harvey Weinstein or even politicians, I mean, religion is supposed to encourage ethics and morality. Yet you have it. You have that misbehavior in religious institutions probably as much as you have it anywhere else. You also mentioned, you know, how institutions could kind of, I don't know, just guard themselves from these possibilities. So, you know, what's interesting to me is, and, you know, we're recording at a time where there are several significant scandals in the American Jewish community. Maybe that's true all the time, but there's a few that's really been, they've been in the paper for, in the media for a while. And it's always amazing to me how poorly equipped these big institutions are to really handle this. I tried to show that in the book too. Even a place like a big rabbinical school that's been around for a long time, very often very, very poorly equipped to handle accusations and how you adjudicate accusations. And then if the accusations are true, what happens next? So, I mean, I'm not going to say, I don't have like a homiletic reason for writing the book. It was, I wanted to have a good story that surfaced these issues. But if something comes from it, yeah, I'd like to have discussions about, okay, so how do we retroact? How can we be proactive in guarding our institutions and making sure that we understand what the procedures are going to be next time this happens?
So your book does not avoid at all challenging hot button issues in Jewish life. Totally on the contrary, actually, like I feel as if you could take sort of an arbitrary screenshot of the front page of pretty much any Jewish newspaper the past 10 or 20 years. And like most of the things discussed on that front page are in your book in some way or another. There's, you know, there's stuff around Israel-Palestine in your book. There's stuff related to donors and funding. There's stuff related to gender and misgendering of characters. There's a lot of pieces of what comes up in Jewish life. And I say that actually with appreciation for, I can't prove this, but I feel like there's a hesitation in many authors who are looking at like Jewish life. I mean, there's not that many books that, you know, center all the characters in a rabbinical seminary, right? But like, I think there are many books that do center Jewish characters. And I think there's a real nervousness around, you know, oh, if I paint this Jewish character or this set of Jewish characters as bad, I'm going to sort of serve anti-Semites and it's going to be bad and this is going to be misused. And while I understand where that fear comes from, I think we have to get past it, because the reality is we do have sexual assault in Jewish life. We do have, I mean, your book doesn't go into issues of race so much, but like we do have racism in Jewish life. We do have all sorts. We have the issues of any part of society present in Jewish life. And if we don't give them just portrayals in works of fiction and, you know, also nonfiction, like we're really, I worry about the world where we don't have those stories more than I worry about the world where we do and they're misused. So I'm curious, when you're, you know, looking to open up all these different issues, like what goes into that and what were you, I know that authors aren't always trying to, you know, here's my agenda for the world, but like to the extent that you do have one on those issues or otherwise, how do you go about conveying it to folks?
Any attempt to censor yourself or to guard against, you know, straying into controversial areas is the death of a novelist, you know, in my opinion. It's the death of fiction. It's the death of literature. You have to let the story evolve the way the story is going to evolve. I mean, and it depends on the genre that you're writing in, but this particular sort of realistic fiction, I had to write it the way I thought things would happen without censoring anything. I guess the other thing I'd say is that, I don't know if I would say this is an agenda, but it's something that's important to me. To me, the Jewish community is just a really interesting community. I mean, for better or for worse. And I mean, for better or for worse means that there's a depth to the Jewish community. There's a texture that includes scandal, but it also includes wonderful ways or tricky ways or ways that are in error that we handle these particular scandals. And so I wanted to, you know, portray a Jewish community that was actually rich in its texture. And if you're going to do that, then you have to include everything. You have to include the good decisions, the bad decisions, the tricky decisions, the betrayals, because all that is true to a community that's got depth, that has the texture that's worthy of important fiction.
Yeah, I mean, there was one page actually that I dog-eared in the book, because, you know, I'm reading this book about ostensibly another topic, and then there was this line where it's talking about these two different funders of the big institution, and they have different views about Israel, you know, and maybe that was what was involved in this story in a certain way, and then the head of the seminary says, "Not so billionaire twins. One says fire him, the other says make him king of the Jews." You know, truer words have never been written in a book. And it's like that something like that, not only funding, which is sort of obvious that I think a lot of organizations are always worrying about their funding, but that specifically funding as it relates to people's positions on Israel is involved even in a sex scandal. That's where I did not have to suspend disbelief.
The idea, of course, that you have to take donors into consideration in everything you do is really true. It's been true in every job I've had. And also the fact that seems like everything goes back to Israel. There's like a Godwin's law, like in Jewish community, that everything ultimately gets to BDS. You know, that's and where you stand on BDS. So it doesn't matter if the original scandal has nothing to do with that. Your donors are going to care about that, and you have to take that into consideration. So a little bit tongue in cheek, but again, I was trying to write realistically. I tried to portray that dynamic in the book.
Yeah, and if anything, you know, we're possibly arcing into more conversations about boycott, divestment, sanctions. But shifting gears a little, although I don't think this is fully going to shift gears, I think it's actually deeply related. I do want to talk about Planet of the Jews, which is your earlier book, not quite as, you know, fresh and new, but I think deeply relevant in many ways. And without going into all the details of Planet of the Jews, you create this future universe, but it's also taking place in present day for when it was written. And I really loved the disorientation of that. I felt like embedded in your book was some really important commentary about Jewish memory, about how we relate to the Jewish past and specifically the Holocaust, how today we might think about that. And also, and this is where it got really interesting, you know, in a few hundred years, people might or might not be relating to that. There's a fascinating scene very early in your book where somebody's reflecting on the Holocaust in a few hundred years, and they're like, oh, I don't really, it's hard for me to connect to that. Like, I don't know exactly what that historical, but I try to read a little bit, but it's clearly very distant. And I think that's actually, you know, it terrifies us to think about this, but that actually might be perfectly realistic. So I'm curious, what was Planet of the Jews doing? And while it strikes as a very different genre, maybe, from what Women in God is doing, I'm curious if there's also threads that you would connect between the two?
Planet of the Jews was meant to be about the struggle for Jewish authenticity. Like there's this main character who's this comic book writer, and he's an editor of a science fiction journal. And he's a secular Jew. He's removed from organized Jewish experience. But he craves also, he craves some kind of meaning in his life. He's going through, it's funny, at the time I thought of him as a midlife crisis. Now it seems like he's much younger. he's in his mid-30s. So kind of facing a sort of a midlife crisis. And he got divorced. So he wants something authentic in his life. Doesn't know what it's going to be. So he's trying to write this first serious thing he's ever written, this Holocaust cartoon. But the thing is, he doesn't have the background. He doesn't know enough about it. So he doesn't know what to do. He's like getting these cartoon figures, and he's trying to write this cartoon novel about the Holocaust, and he's just stumbling. And then he meets these two authentic Jews, to his mind, his authentic Jews. And that's the couple that writes these, what become extremely successful science fiction short stories that take over the Jewish world and take over the non-Jewish world. They become very, very popular. And they're somehow, because they have an authentic approach to Jewish spirituality, they're something that the main character is yearning for, but he's unable to reach. And there's some question whether they even exist, you know, they're just figments of his imagination, because he gets credit for writing those stories and nobody else has ever met them before. So maybe like in his head, they're actually his yearning for Jewish authenticity, which, not giving away too much, he never really gets it. He never gets that Jewish authenticity. So the story is sort of his own tragedy. And I was trying to say it's kind of like the American Jewish tragedy of wanting meaning, really, really craving authenticity, but not having quite enough of a thick culture to provide that authenticity. And that's kind of the tragedy, but it's also kind of the conundrum that fuels the book. Will American Judaism ever have that thickness of culture where we will really discover authentic meaning that can transform our lives? When I first started to write, there was no question that I was going to write science fiction and fantasy, because I'm a big fan. Unlike a lot of serious people, I sort of felt the best way to convey a real grappling with ideas happens in science fiction, because you try to imagine what the world's going to be like and what the problems are today and how they're going to be in 100 years. And you can really grapple with ideas in science fiction. So I just assumed every book I would write would be science fiction. So then I started to write Planet of the Jews, and I realized that, hey, this isn't really science fiction, because the frame story takes place now in the current day, and the science fiction is in the cloak of stories. So it ended up being more of a novel about someone who's interested in science fiction than actually a science fiction novel. Although, by the way, it's my most popular book. Of course, that's a relative term, but you know, it's a book.
Oh, no, Lex posted something about this on Facebook. It was actually just a picture of his table, and it had Planet of the Jews on it. And all of a sudden, the Planet of the Jews, what's it called? The Planet of the Jews cult came out of the, you know, and people were commenting about it, how they read sections of it every year. It was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's used in confirmation classes very often in synagogues. So these high school kids, every once in a while, I'll hear from a kid that read it in high school, you know, who's in his 20s or 30s now. So I would say that it ended up being a comment on American Judaism, as opposed to some kind of speculation about where American Judaism is going. Because the science fiction part, which were those stories, they sort of veer all over the place. And I was trying to kind of throw into those stories, what is it that American Jews are craving? What kind of ideas, what kind of spirituality would really allow us to kind of flourish spiritually? Or is there anything that's in there at all?
I think what you said about how science fiction really opens up ideas. I did not grow up super excited about science fiction. And in certain ways, I was like ideological about that. Like, imagine, you know, teenage Lex with a lot of hot takes about everything. And I like was really, I read fiction, but I read mostly like realistic fiction, you know, stuff that took place today or in like defined areas of history, where, you know, authors do research about what happened and they sort of try to stay. Like, I was not somebody who spent a lot of time in fantasy and science fiction. And lately, I've shifted gears on that, both in the film I watch and the books I read. I've been reading a lot of Ursula Le Guin, really classic, incredible author of science fiction, who definitely is wading into ideological kinds of conversations through her work. And I think that in many ways, this is not a true statement, but like science fiction and fantasy are more realistic than realistic fiction in certain senses. I think there's a way in which creating a fake universe allows you to reflect on your own in a really effective way. And I found that with Planet of the Jews, that it did allow me to back out and say, oh, huh, yeah, like we're asking, you know, where could the world go in a few hundred years? It doesn't really matter if I think that's exactly what's going to happen, but it does allow me to zoom back into my own time and say, like, oh, what are our trajectories? What's the multiverse of possibilities that could branch out from where we are today? And so I'm interested in the potential of that for Jews, for Judaism, for Jewishness, whatever we want to call it, because for whatever set of reasons, I don't think that when we've been carving out visions for the Jewish future that we've thought, you know, fiction books are where we're going to find it. I think, you know, I'm being hypocritical even as I say this, we're like a think tank in certain senses. And like, I think think tanks are where people think of, you know, big ideas and publications that are, you know, nonfiction, articles, essays, etc. But what is it about really ambitious, you know, out there kinds of fiction that in a practical sense or a non-practical sense, we can map onto our lives as Jews and onto our visions for what we want Judaism to be?
All right. So I would say that fiction is an ideal vehicle to help us explore our most important issues in the Jewish world. Now, I say this with all modesty. So let's say it's not about my books. Let's say it's about Jewish literature in general. To me, Jewish fiction is, those are the Jewish texts for today. I mean, what does a great Jewish text do? Great Jewish text doesn't give you answers. A great Jewish text surfaces all sorts of important issues. And then we start arguing about them, talking about them, maybe trying to solve them. So I think a Jewish novel or fiction, Jewish short story, should have that function in today's American Jewish culture, that it's not solving any problems, but it is surfacing all sorts of issues that once we read them and maybe discuss them, we're better equipped than as a Jewish community to be able to handle them. I sort of hope that's what happens in my novels, that there's just, people can take a look at these like you look at a text, and it could be a jumping off point to a very important discussion about what's going on in the Jewish community today. But I'll add one more idea, and this is something of particular depth, and I haven't fully unpacked it yet, but there's a famous science fiction writer that fellow geeks like me will have heard of. I'm not sure if you guys have heard of him, but Orson Scott Card, he's not Jewish, very well-known science fiction writer. He actually is Mormon, which is interesting, and he's got a really profound knowledge of Tanakh, you know, we call Tanakh or the Old Testament. He said a few years ago, I read this as an interview, that the modern theologians are science fiction writers, because science fiction writers are asking the big questions about what's out there, you know, and what's the overall purpose of life. So that's what theology tries to do, to try to ask those questions. What's out there? How do we get to what's out there? How do we find transcendence? And what he said, and I think it's true, and what's increasingly true in modern fiction, is that it can be beautiful, but it's also often very narrow. You know, it's what happened in my office, you know, what happens in my small community. Whereas science fiction is what's out there in the grand universe. What mysteries are there still to uncover? And we don't really have great theologians nowadays, at least not that I'm aware of. But we do have science fiction writers that are asking those questions and then maybe helping us to come to some kind of at least discussion about what's beyond our world.
Yeah, I mean, Orson Scott Card's most famous book is Ender's Game, and it has a few sequels to it. And one of them, I think it was the third one, I think it's called Xenocide, it takes place on a planet where it has kind of a founder's effect of people who had obsessive compulsive disorder. And so they have all these practices that kind of track what we think of as obsessive compulsive disorder. But there, it's not a disorder because everybody, you know, is this way. It's a founder effect. It's the way the society is. And that book has stuck with me on such a deep level in my own sort of explorations of Judaism, not to say that Judaism is founded by people with obsessive compulsive disorder. The point is more that you can kind of see how a founder's effect has a huge impact on what's going to come later. And it doesn't necessarily have a good reason why we do things this way. It's just because this is who our founders were, and this is what they were concerned about and how they did it. And that's been so significant in my own thinking about Judaism. And, you know, I trace it not only to science fiction as a genre, but to a very particular book that I could pull off my shelf and find. And that does feel to me very much like how your typical, you know, yeshiva student thinks about a theologian.
When I read that book, I thought, he's writing about Jewish ritual. You know, he's writing about halacha, Jewish law, because it's so beautiful in the book. I mean, the characters that engage in these rituals, which, you know, from the outside, they look like mindless rituals, but the characters that engage in these rituals are doing it with such a love, you know, and such a full heart. And yet the reader knows, no, it's just OCD. You know, so then we ask the question, you know, are certain of our Jewish rituals, are they motivated only by some OCD? Do they have that same kind of strength and power? Are they authentic? Are they really the way to reach God? Or is that an illusion? Now, the book, I don't think, solves that. And we can't solve that. But reading it brings up that really fascinating question. You know, what happens when Jewish rituals sort of move towards OCD? And then we take a step back, but still you need that commitment to really engage in them and to build a thick Jewish culture. So you're right, that book is a perfect example. The previous book, by the way, as long as we're geeking out on Orson Scott Card, is Speaker of the Dead.
And, amazing book.
It's a great reflection on mourning practices and what are the proper mourning practices. There's a lot more in that novel. Mm-hmm. It's also a novel about sentience and how do you recognize sentience. But for me as a rabbi, the idea that he brings about mourning and how a clergy helps a family mourn was just incredibly beautiful.
So in the spirit of jumping between times like Planet of the Jew does, jumping between books now, I want to go back to Woman and God a little, but now we've established both. So really, you know, weave the Grobart cinematic universe between the different books, if you would like. I'm saying this only positively, but I read a non-zero amount of cynicism about Jewish institutions, or at least, I mean, you don't necessarily talk about like 100 different Jewish institutions, but you dive deeply into one. And I appreciated that cynicism once again, for all the reasons I mentioned before, how we need to think expansively, think deeply, and not only shine a positive light on centerpieces of Jewish life. I would love to learn more, though, about this story that centers a specific rabbi. She's a woman. She is in Las Vegas is where she serves a congregation. I think that we could spend about an hour on like any of a million threads from, oh, Las Vegas and Judaism. What does that mean? To Jewish summer camps. That plays a key role. And so, like, there's a lot. So help us just sort of gain a better sense of what all the pieces are in this book.
Well, let me just give you two ideas, kind of two themes that I was playing with in the book. I mean, so one is, how do we handle disappointment and disillusionment in Judaism or in general, just as a human emotion? In Women and God, it's not giving anything away. It's a little hard to talk about it because it's a suspense novel. So, you know, if I give away too many details, I don't want to ruin it for anybody. But you have this main character, Moshe, you know, who is this spiritual giant who's accused in the very first page. So this isn't going to ruin it for anybody, of sexual misbehavior. And the reader is pretty sure something's happened. So I'm not ruining anything. But then he's got this student. I mean, the student is Yael, who's the main character of the book. And she adored Moshe. And he was a very, very important spiritual figure in her life. Back at camp, it's called Camp Tikva in the book. It may bear some resemblance to Camp Ramah. I'm not gonna say yes or no, but maybe some of you will find something familiar if you know about Camp Ramah. But back then, she's 12, 13 years old, and he's an important spiritual mentor. And then in rabbinical school, she has him as a professor. But she finds out, and she actually has to investigate him, and she starts to realize this guy really let her down, you know, and she's very, very disappointed in it. And then she has to kind of make that decision. Okay, so what do I do? Can I separate the teaching from the teacher, because the teaching has defined her rabbinic career. It's defined her life. It's defined her spiritual identity. And then she finds out there's this corruption, maybe deep, deep corruption in the teacher. So what does that do to all of his teachings? And again, in the book, I don't necessarily give an answer, but I give a character that's really struggling with that. So that was important to me. And the second thing I was trying to get at, so this is where Las Vegas comes from, because, I mean, what could be more corrupt than Las Vegas? I mean, I picked Las Vegas on purpose, where the possibilities of corruption, you know, there's a backstory, which was, it was hard for me actually to write the backstory. She'd had a scandal before Yael in her synagogue, in her Las Vegas synagogue, which had to do with gambling and the whole connection of the Jewish community to the gambling industry. So already there is some corruption that's touched her spiritual life, her being rabbi of the synagogue. So I'm trying to explore also, I mean, what do we do when we have corruption in our institutions, corruption in our environment, and yet we struggle to hold on to some authentic spirituality?
At one point, I was working on a book that the discussion was, you know, whether this would only appeal to a Jewish audience. And the person in publishing said, well, Jews buy a lot of books. Like, that wasn't necessarily a bad thing. And yet, it feels to me like there aren't so many authors out there that are writing stories that are really kind of inward looking about Jewish life. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, you know, the economics or lack of economics of being an author, because I'm assuming that there's not a lot of economics to it. And so then the question becomes, in a way, there are a lot of things that we do in Jewish life that don't pay anything. Like, we spend 3 hours a week. Not I don't, but I mean, a lot of people spend 3 hours a week in a synagogue, you know, on Shabbat. That's not paying anything. You know, they do all kinds of things in Jewish life, but somehow it doesn't seem that writing novels has achieved the place in Jewish life of saying, hey, that's a really great Jewish thing to do, even though you're not going to get paid for it. Can you talk a little bit about that and about whether you think that there's maybe ways that we could try to lead to the writing of more stories?
One thing I'll say first is, you're right, it's really hard. The effort that I put into getting a book published nowadays is almost the same as the effort in writing it. But the effort in writing it is a lot more fun, you know, and a lot more, you know, valuable to my own soul. And I feel like that's just gotten worse over the years as publishing has consolidated. I mean, there used to be, you know, more places where you could just publish books that were in-depth explorations of Jewish life in America. I don't think there's any Jewish publisher that publishes fiction right now. So that's what a loss that is. And there are some publishers, non-Jewish publishers, like Fig Tree Press is one that just comes to mind, that they do publish Jewish novels, but they don't exclusively publish Jewish novels. And I don't think there's anything other than Fig Tree that really looks out and tries to find Jewish novels. So it's very, very hard. And there are a lot of great writers out there, but it's very, very hard to get published. And you're right that the marketplace is really awful. I mean, you can't make a living doing it. And, you know, I've always had to write very, very part-time, and it takes me years to write a book because I've always had other jobs. And so it's very, very hard. And there are, you know, good writers out there, I think, that lose motivation, despite the fact that it's a passion project and that you go into it with a sense of passion. It's still, at some point, you need motivation to continue. And I think that motivation, unfortunately, is just not there. And this is one of my pet peeves. I feel like that the Jewish community could and should do more to encourage Jewish creative writing. And I guess I start from the place that a great culture needs to have opportunities to create culture. So, like, Jewish books and Jewish music and Jewish theater, Jewish fiction. And if we don't have that, we sink as a culture. We stop giving our children things that are really fascinating that they can grapple with. And I think that's a shame. Years ago, I was actually in New York vacationing. You know, I spent a lot of time in New York working or studying, but my wife and I just went there on a vacation. And we took a walking tour of Harlem. Yeah, it was interesting because I lived adjacent to Harlem for many, many years when I was at the Jewish Theological Seminary. You know, and they always told us to stay away from Harlem because it's dangerous. And I did, like the 5 years I lived there, I never, even though I was on 120th, so I was very close to Harlem, I never went to Harlem. And then it wasn't until I could go on vacation and take this walking tour. So we were walking, we did this walking tour of Harlem. It's fascinating because it's a really solid introduction to African-American culture. So we passed by this museum. It wasn't a big museum, kind of a storefront museum, but it was a museum of African-American writers. And also we found out that it's like a foundation that supports African-American writing, Black American writing. There is a philanthropic system in Harlem to support African-American writers. And there's nothing like that in the Jewish community. Now, we have the means to do it. I mean, we certainly have a great philanthropic structure that we've created, but none of it supports Jewish fiction at this point. Some of it supports some music. There were organizations in the past that went out of business, but you guys, I mean, because this is the point of your podcast, I mean, you know how stuck much of American Jewish philanthropy is in just focusing on Israel and anti-Semitism and not in producing great Jewish culture. And to me, the project of producing great Jewish culture means to produce the means of writing novels. And it's not just grants or you know, just seeking out or maybe a Jewish fiction publishing house. We have none of that. We had something like it about 25, 30 years ago. We don't have it anymore. And sooner or later, there's going to be just fewer Jewish writers writing. And I think the culture is really going to suffer for that.
You actually sort of anticipated where I was going, which is around how American Jews, whether it's American Jewish philanthropists or just American Jews generally, how we conceptualize success or how we sort of measure whether Judaism is secure for the future, or all these things. Like you mentioned your counterfactual before, and that whole conception. I'm imagining a counterfactual for a second. I'm imagining a parallel Jewish universe where we've got studies like the Pew study that came out earlier this year and the one before that, you know, 7 years before, where the big anxiety that everybody's nervous about and everybody's measuring is, have Jews nationwide read enough Jewish fiction? Have Jews, you know, read the latest works like Magical Princess Harriet, which we spoke with that author, Leah Moser? Have they read Rachie Lewis's book? Have they read Phil Grover's book? Like, we're in a crisis mode because people aren't reading enough Jewish fiction books. And, oh, yeah, sure, there's like people marrying whoever they're marrying, but that's not our core thing. And, oh, yeah, like people have whatever thoughts about Israel and Palestine. Oh, yeah, people like God belief, yes, no, but like Jewish fiction, are they reading it? Are they exploring it? Are they writing it? Are we funding it? We're going to set up a Jewish institution that's devoted to doing that. We're going to find, you know, focus groups, and we're going to set up task forces to then do the more focus groups. Like, that's not the world we have. We have a world that sees Jewish fiction as like, sure, we would love people to go to synagogue, mark the holidays, light the old candles on Friday night. If they also read some books of Jewish fiction, like, great, super. But we don't see it as like, it would actually be a success story if somebody read Jewish fiction and was interested in that and like didn't do any of the other affiliational stuff. That's seen, I'm not saying on an individual level, if we asked a funder, like, is that person doing Judaism wrong? I don't think the funder would be like, oh, that's a bad Jew. But I think we haven't set up our systems where that's sort of a core goal, Jewish fiction reading, and the candle lighting and the holiday marking and the Israel stuff is separate. And so I'm curious, like, I've set up a hyperbolic world. Is it a good world? Is like, should we go for that one?
Let me put it this way, and I'm speaking as a rabbi, you know, here, but most Jews are not going to resonate with a deep study of Talmud. As much as I love Talmud, you guys love Talmud too, you know, I'm inspired by Talmud. Most American Jews are just not going to resonate to even a line of Talmud, or to Bible with Rashi, with, you know, with a commentary, or Midrash, you know, our classic Jewish sources. Most Jews can read and learn from Jewish literature. A good Jewish novel can make people think deeply about their Jewish identity, what they want to do as a Jew, where they want to go with that Jewish identity. I agree totally. I mean, and so, and the question we want to ask is, are we producing those novels? Now, it so happens that we are. I mean, there are some really interesting younger Jewish writers out there. To me, it's as good as it's ever been. They're not all that well known, right? It's not kind of the golden age of the 60s and 70s of Philip Roth and Malamud. But in some ways, I feel like these writers are just as good, just as talented, and asking questions that need to be discussed in the American Jewish community, but with no institutional support. If we want the culture to move forward, sure, there's the Talmud's there, the Midrash is there, Tanakh and Rashi and the commentaries, it's all there. It's only going to scratch the surface of a large segment of our community. But Jewish novels, poetry, music, plays, all that, without all that much preparation, can sink into a Jewish soul and create important discussions about Jewish identity and ultimately create connections.
It just feels to me like, maybe this is the plot of your next novel, but it feels to me like there's something very deeply amiss where what success looks like is solely defined by engagement with some old material and not at all measured as the production of new material. And I guess my question is on both the supply side and the demand side. There was this grant proposal RFP out there recently called the Reset Grants, which was about sort of painting this world of a reset Jewish community, that would look profoundly different. And I think they got something like 300 proposals. I don't know how many made it to the next round. But some of us who were not elevated to the next round were talking about, hey, maybe we should have on this podcast in a few months, maybe we should have some opportunities where we actually talk to people about their vision. Like, what was that reset Jewish community that they could imagine? And I'm curious, as somebody who's writing Jewish novels, like, is there a dimension to you that you could actually see in concrete terms about how it would look in terms of what the world of whether it's funders or whoever else out there could do that would move the needle in the way that we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I'll start the answer by saying there are some organizations out there. So I don't want to give the impression that there's nothing out there. There are some organizations that are trying. There's still the Jewish Book Council, which I think does support, unfortunately, in very modest ways, but it does support the idea of Jewish books, and they fiction is in there. I worked for a little while for the National Jewish Book Center. And the National Jewish Book Center does support some Jewish writing. They have a very interesting program, which I participated in, where they brought teachers and where they brought teachers from Jewish day schools and helped them to teach Jewish literature. When I worked there, we had a program for Jewish writers where we would bring Jewish writers to come and meet each other. And it was a little meant to be, didn't really take off, but it was meant to be something like Yaddo. Yaddo is a writer's colony where you get paid to sit and write. And then you get this fellowship of other writers. I don't think the models are very hard to find. Yaddo is a model. I mean, so it wouldn't even cost that. Well, I mean, in terms of some of the budgets of some of these organizations, just to have a writer's colony of Jewish writers that come for a summer, produce something, will pay you a stipend and help each other kind of develop the ideas. Or is it too much to ask for one Jewish publishing house that publishes fiction? Right now, I think there's zero. So to have one publishing house that's nonprofit, that doesn't only work on marketplace logic, but actually looks for the next great five Jewish novels that are going to really set the agenda for discussion. I think there should be three or four. There used to be. And it's not like we have less money now, and it's not like we're better off culturally now. So we don't need that anymore. So, I think one writer's colony, two or three Jewish publishing houses, I'd be very happy with that.
Take notes, everybody listening. These are good proposals. I had one more question about Women in God that I wanted to bring up, which I think there's a challenge that comes up. I mean, I haven't written a book, so I can't speak to this personally, but I can imagine a challenge that not yet. There you go. Quoting Franz Rosenzweig, like to say not yet. But I think there's a challenge. I could perceive a challenge where, you have dialogue in a book and you have characters who are saying things that the reader is taking as offensive. But it's a novel. You're not writing, nonfiction prose where you can say, and this sentence was meant to be offensive. And dear reader, please take that into account. I bring this up because there's a character in Women in God who's non-binary. who uses they, them pronouns. And once again, that's not a big spoiler. I mean, it shouldn't be a spoiler that, you know, people with they, them pronouns are in any books. That's, you know, early in the book, you learn that. And at a number of points in the novel, other characters misgender them, referring to them with she, her pronouns. And because in a novel like this, I understand you're not able to like rebuke your characters and say that that's not what you want them to be doing. But I did want to bring it up because it feels important in a climate that we live in where there are people that erase non-binary folks that claim that the only true genders in the world are those that are assigned as birth at birth as male, female, and that non-binary is sort of an illusion. I wanted to open up the chance for you to sort of discuss that part of your book. What were you trying to do with the characters who sort of treated them in ways that we as readers would oppose?
Right. Yeah, it's a great question. And it was a tricky bit to write. I mean, the non-binary character in the novel is really the victim, kind of the first victim of sexual misconduct. And the way the institution deals with them, I mean, that would be the pronoun we would use, is really a mark of their integrity. And the fact is that that's the first failure that we see in the institution is their failure to deal with them on the level of, first of all, that identity, but also just as a human being at all. And to me, the only way to do that realistically was to have all the characters that are involved in dismissing them be guilty of that, because that's the first hint to the reader that something corrupt is going on. Let me also just respond in a deeper way. And this is, I think, readers can decide whether I did this well or not, but a challenge in the book, there are characters that I hope that the reader admires, but are clearly imperfect. So almost every character does something terrible. You can't have this authorial voice that says, hey, that was terrible. I want you to, I'm the writer, Grobart here, thinks it's terrible. I can't just do that. So the reader just has to pick up on it. And one of the challenges for me is I wrote in the voice of Moishe, you know, who is that spiritual charismatic. And in writing in his voice, I had to give him some sympathy. But I personally am not sympathetic to him. But that's a hard balance. I was trying to get into his head, but I didn't want to go easy on him. I wanted people to know him and understand him, but I also wanted people to judge him. And that's difficult to do when I'm getting in his head, but I didn't want it to come off as like a sermon. So again, I mean, the reader can judge whether I did this successfully or not, but it is a challenge.
It really did strike me when Lex posted that Facebook post where it just had the cover of Planet of the Jews, and all of a sudden these people are coming out of the woodwork saying it. They read it every year. They read from it every year. That somehow it's kind of kicking around in their head, and that's a great achievement as a novelist. I'm wondering if you can talk about or think about a little bit whether it's that novel or other novels where you feel like you've really hit it. And if there are folks that are out there saying, you know, I've got a story to tell, what are some of the things that they ought to take seriously in order to do it well, but not just as a novel, but also as kind of a way to help the Jews?
My pat answer to, you know, what novel do I really think succeeded is that I always feel like the last one is my best. And that's actually, you know, good for me to say. You know, I feel like I used to say that when I was a pulpit rabbi. I used to say my best sermon was the sermon I just gave, because that's the one I put all my energy and focus in. I don't even remember the other ones. And so I feel like Women and God at this point is my best novel, because that's my latest novel. I sort of have a sentimental attachment to Planet of the Jews, because it was my first novel. I still hear from people about it occasionally. I'll still get like an email or a letter about it. Now, what you should do, you know, to write a novel, it's going to sound simple, but you need to put in the time. I mean, it's not about creativity. I mean, I think that comes naturally to most human beings, especially anybody that wants to write a novel has some idea. What you have to do is organize your life so that you have the time that you're going to sit there and you're going to write several hours a day. You have to write every day, because otherwise you're going to forget. You know, you're going to get what the story's about. You're going to, you know, forget the kind of style that you want to have in the book itself. So you have to write several hours every day. That's very hard if you have another job. So you have to really want to do it a lot. I try to have the entire plot worked out in the novel before I begin to write, because then I feel like I'm not stuck as often. You know, I'll have the outline. For each of my novels, I've probably had 25, 30 page outlines, detailed outlines about the plot. And I don't have to follow it completely, but I generally follow it pretty completely. Otherwise, I think you just get lost. And I definitely recommend that for a first novel. Just make sure you know what you're writing before you sit down and really tackle the prose. Also, the advantage is then you can go back and rewrite, revise as much as you want, but you're not going to face all these logical inconsistencies that happen in a story.
Closing on logical inconsistencies in the story, that's some kind of profound. We'll have to drash on that. Like, may we all have logical inconsistencies in our stories, and may we resolve them when we can. Thank you so much, Phil Grobart, for joining us. This has been a fantastic conversation.
Thank you. It's been a delight.
And thank you so much to all of you out there for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation, and we hope that you'll tune in again in the future. Definitely head to the show notes on our website. You can find links to both books that we discussed today written by Philip Grobart. We strongly encourage you to give those a read, and we also strongly encourage you to be in touch with us, and there are a wide variety of ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook, our Instagram, or our Twitter. All of those handles are at Judaism Unbound. And then you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com, and you can always email us at either dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last request we'd like to make is that we deeply appreciate any amount of financial donation that you're able to send our way, and you can do that by heading to judaismunbound.com/donate. And the last little note is that support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC empowers you to experience Jewish paths toward a life of joy, purpose, and meaning through innovative Jewish learning and wellness programs, community building, and initiatives to develop the next generation of Jewish leaders. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.